we are in Genesis chapter 48, quickly approaching the end of the time that we've got and of the book of Genesis, which I guess that's good that we're doing both of those at the same time. We've got three classes left and three chapters left, and hopefully we can get through them in that order. I'd rather not have to break things up too much. 49 is a bit more content than 50 is, and so we may have to divide it up a little bit. But the goal is obviously in these last 3 weeks to wrap up these three chapters. And as we look at these three chapters, it's kind of interesting to look at them kind of as a unit, because they're really concerned with two basic things. One, or I guess you might say really both, having to do with promises that God made to Abraham. And that may not be immediately apparent, but really what it all boils down to is one of two things that these chapters are talking about. One, looking into the future, chapters 48 and 49 in particular are dealing with blessing, with Jacob calling Ephraim and Manasseh, or letting Joseph know that he is not well and the end is nearing, and Joseph bringing Ephraim and Manasseh and blessing these two sons in particular, or two grandsons, adopting them as his own sons where they will inherit along with the other brothers. Chapter 49 is the blessing on the 12 sons of Jacob, and not just a general well wish, but a prophetic-filled blessing, a prophecy-filled blessing as well there. So looking off into the future, and not just the future in general, but dealing a lot with things like where they're going to have their inheritance in the land when God gives that back to them, who's going to be carrying the messianic line, and all of those kinds of things. So looking into the future and those things related to the promises that God has made. And then the other thing that is a major theme at the end of chapter 47, the end of chapter 47 that we saw last time, the end of chapter 49, and then really much of chapter 50 is dealing with the question of burial. And we don't typically think of burial as something that's related to the promises of God, except for the fact that all of this emphasis on burial is the fact that you are to take me back to the promised land and bury me there. And so it is a way of emphasizing that the hopes and dreams, the plans of these patriarchs are still rooted in this land that God has promised them. And it is in that not just a bit of nostalgia. It's not just the tradition of the people of that day. I mean, there is some of that as well, to be buried in the tomb of our forefathers and so forth and so on. But Abraham already parted with that a long time ago when he purchased a cave in this land to bury his wife. He doesn't take her back to Mesopotamia to bury her there. He buries her in that land, and that's what the rest of these guys are doing. So it's not just this family tradition and custom of being buried in the land of the family. It's really rooted in the fact that God has promised this land to these people and to their descendants. And even though they've been told already that they would not inherit this land themselves, and it would be their descendants who would inherit the land, and they would be captive for four generations, and it wouldn't be until much later that they come back and take this land, their focus is still to take me back to that place. And there are two things then that are going on as we get through this. Jacob has told Joseph already in chapter 47. He's going to tell all of his children in chapter 49, bury me there in Canaan when I die. And this is when Joseph has the authority as, you know, the prime minister of Egypt to take his father back and bury him there. And he does. And so this tomb there in the promised land with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob and their wives in it stands when the Israelites return to the land in the time of Joshua. That tomb stands as a memorial to their faith that one day they would inherit this land and their confidence that that is the case. And it would be the sort of thing that would be impressive, to say the least, to this generation that's coming into the land to see the faith of their forefathers manifest in this tomb itself. Now, it's a little bit different with Joseph, and we'll talk more about that when we get to chapter 50. But Joseph doesn't say, take me back and bury me there now. Because when Joseph dies, they no longer have that kind of authority, that sort of lasting authority to go back. Things have changed significantly with the death of Joseph in terms of their political power. And so what Joseph says is, when the time comes, take me back and bury me there then. But that instruction and the coffin of Joseph, so to speak, still stands as testimony to the faith of Joseph, that one day God would, in fact, take them back there. And so whether the bones are taken back, as with Jacob, or the bones are left resting in Egypt waiting for that time to come, they're both speaking in very different ways about the same thing, which is confidence in God's promises that this land is what God intends for them. And so it's perhaps a little subtle. It just looks like a bunch of talk about being buried. But in the broader context of Genesis and the promises of God, I think it really is this focus on the promised land itself. That's kind of big picture on the last three chapters and what we're going to be encountering as we move forward. Any thoughts here before we get into the text of chapter 48? All right, the first seven verses. After this, Joseph was told, "Behold, your father is ill." So he took with him his two sons, Manasseh and Ephraim. And it was told to Jacob, "Your son Joseph has come to you." Then Israel summoned his strength and sat up in bed. And Jacob said to Joseph, "God Almighty appeared to me at Luz in the land of Canaan and blessed me and said to me, 'Behold, I will make you fruitful and multiply you. I will make of you a company of peoples, and will give this land to your offspring after you for an everlasting possession. And now your two sons, who were born to you in the land of Egypt before I came to you in Egypt, are mine. Ephraim and Manasseh shall be mine, as Reuben and Simeon are. And the children that you fathered after them shall be yours, and they shall be called by the name of their brothers and their inheritance. As for me, when I came from Paddan, to my sorrow Rachel died in the land of Canaan on the way, when there was still some distance to go to Ephrath, and I buried her there on the way to Ephrath," that is Bethlehem. So a few things here as we get into the text itself. Just kind of in passing, and I don't want to get too bogged down on this point, but it's interesting, and it's one of those glimpses into the reality of life in Egypt now that we probably don't think about that much, is that Joseph isn't right there with his family all the time. He has brought them down to provide for them. He has put them in the land of Goshen, which is a little bit away from kind of the center of Egyptian life. And that's, again, in part because that's going to be good grazing land after the famine is all done. But it's also because it allows them to grow without any sort of foreign influence into the nation that God wants them to be. It's also because the Egyptians think shepherds are an abomination, and that's what they are. And so all of this is working together. But what it means is that Joseph is not living right next door to his dad. And part of the reality of life is that when Jacob is ill and nearing the end of his life, Joseph has to be told about this. So between the fact that they're not living right next to each other and Joseph's position in Egypt probably keeps him pretty occupied so that he's not, you know, going out to visit every weekend or anything. And we don't really know what his role would have been after the famine was done. You know, does he continue to have a high position of authority? Does his responsibilities shift to something different now? Again, we just don't know. The Bible's not interested in telling us that. But presuming that he kept a position of authority of some kind, he doesn't have a ton of free time. That's just the reality of that kind of job. And so Joseph has to be told that this is the case. And so he brings his sons to his father to be blessed by the patriarch, the one who has received the promises from God, to be blessed by this one. And I don't know if this is exactly what's going on in Joseph's mind, but it's worth noting that part of what this is going to do then is tie these sons of an Egyptian mother who's the daughter of a pagan priest, into the promises of the covenant of God. And it's bringing Ephraim and Manasseh more directly into this covenant family. And I don't think that the reality is that they would have been like cut off in some way otherwise, but it's a very formalized way of bringing them into the covenant community. Notice also, as we've said before, it's really hard to pin down what's going on with the name change with Jacob. Unlike Abraham, he gets the new name Israel, and he's not Israel just from that point on all the way, rest of the way through. There's some back and forth between Jacob and Israel, and most of the time it's really hard to know what's going on. We saw earlier when he learns that Joseph is alive after all, Jacob regained his strength and Israel said, you know, so forth and so on. And that seems to be an intentional change by the author to this covenant name. And that seems to be the case here in verse 2 as well. Jacob is ill in bed, and Israel summoned up his strength and sat up in bed and moves on to this blessing. But it doesn't stick with Israel after that point either. So again, it's hard to know for sure what's going on, but there does seem to be this intentional illness and frailty to summoning up his strength and imparting these covenant-related blessings with this covenant name that God has given him. Seems to be an intentional maneuver. But again, even here, what does that mean in terms of every other back and forth between Jacob and Israel in the text? Yeah, who knows? It's just really, really hard to say what's going on with that. But this is one of the cases where it does seem to be an intentional move from Jacob to Israel that has some sort of significance one way or another. Notice also that he moves pretty quickly to talking about Bethel, his encounter with God in Bethel. And a few things that are worth noting here. One is it's really hard to be certain whether he's talking about the first encounter with God at Bethel when he's leaving the Promised Land, or his second encounter with God at Bethel as he's coming back, because he's not exhaustive in his detail. He doesn't tell us everything that there is to say about what happens at Bethel. But that said, it's also, I think, worth noting that we're probably more inclined to draw a grand distinction between the two than Jacob would have been. Jacob has two encounters with God at Bethel in different ways, and there's a sense in which the two are one in terms of the message that God is giving to Jacob on either side of the journey out to Paddan Aram. But at the same time, there's a whole lot of similarity. But it's interesting, especially as you think about the second encounter with God at Bethel. He doesn't mention the fact that God changes his name. Of course, if he's only thinking of the first one, that would be a part of that. But it's worth noting that the change of his name is completely left out of this, which may be a way of minimizing his side of things. It's not about Jacob. It's not about Israel. It's not about me. It's about what God has been doing. God appeared to me at Luz. That's the ancient name for what we now know of as Bethel, in the land of Canaan, and blessed me and said to me, "Behold, I will make you for..." And it's all about what God has done and the promises of God for the future generations and what God is accomplishing, not anything about Jacob. Also, notice that part of the promise that's left out here is kings will come from you. This is one of those parts of the promise that works its way through, starting with Abraham. Kings will come from you. And it shows up in the encounter of Jacob and God at Bethel as well. Kings will come from you. But he leaves that out. And again, it's hard to know. And this is something you're probably getting tired of hearing me say in this class. It's hard to know exactly what's going on when the narrator doesn't tell us. But it is worth noting that this is the first of two chapters that are dealing with blessings on his sons and his sons' sons and so forth and so on. And this is Jacob and Joseph and Ephraim and Manasseh. And there's a really good reason, and I don't know for sure if this is why Jacob does it, but there's a really good reason why he wouldn't mention the king's thing when he's talking to Joseph and Ephraim and Manasseh. That's because it's not relevant to Joseph and Ephraim and Manasseh. That part of the promise is coming for Judah in the next chapter. And he's going to talk specifically about the scepter not departing from Judah, which is clearly a reference to kingship. In that context. And so that may be intentional for him to leave that aspect of this discussion with God out, because that's irrelevant to what we're doing here today. There is a promise, and there is a promise that God made to me, and there is a promise that's relevant to you, Joseph, and to your sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, but this isn't part of it that's related to you, and so I'm leaving that out. And that certainly makes sense of why that would be left out. Whether or not, again, that's his intent, is hard to say. Charlie? Yeah, there needs to be a specifying of things. You know, here he is in this position of royalty already, and he's the favorite. Everyone kind of presumes he's going to get everything, perhaps. Well, that's not exactly how it's going to work out in this case. And this is also one of the spots where it becomes clear that in the biblical narrative, the birthright and the messianic line, that aspect of the blessing, are not one and the same. And we talked about this when we talked about Jacob and Esau and how the birthright is purchased and then the blessing is stolen, so to speak. Of course, God had promised it for Jacob anyway, so it's kind of hard to steal something that you own. But be that as it may, the way that it works itself out, it sure looks like theft. But the fact that he'd already purchased the birthright doesn't mean that he has the other. The birthright is the double portion of the inheritance, and Joseph is going to receive that. Joseph receives the birthright. He gets twice as much inheritance as the rest of the brothers do, and that's to say that he gets two tribes in the land, and all the rest of the brothers only get one. And Chronicles makes that clear as well in one of the genealogies about Joseph receiving the double portion, the birthright. And so Ephraim and Manasseh inheriting equally with the brothers is the way of giving Joseph that double portion of the inheritance. So Joseph will receive the birthright, Judah will receive the messianic line. And the kingship and other things as well. So he, in this encounter, he adopts Ephraim and Manasseh as his own children. And there is here the first hint of what he's ultimately going to do, although Joseph doesn't pick up on it. Notice back up in verse 1, he took with him his two sons, Manasseh and Ephraim. I don't know if you catch that as you're reading through it, but something about that just doesn't sound right, Manasseh and Ephraim. Because we always say it the other way. It'd be kind of like, you know, if we were talking about, you know, the area that we live in and we said St. Petersburg, Tampa, that something about that just doesn't sound right because you always say it the other way around, Tampa, St. Pete. And that's where we are here as well. Manasseh and Ephraim doesn't sound quite right. We always say it the other way around. This is actually the birth order. Manasseh and Ephraim is the right order, so to speak. And so the narrator gives it to us in that order first, which makes it all the more clear when he says in verse 5, Ephraim and Manasseh shall be mine as Reuben and Simeon are. Jacob has already reversed the order in his talking about them, and he reverses it in the same breath that he lists Reuben and Simeon in their birth order. Ephraim and Manasseh are mine just like Reuben and Simeon are mine. Now, that by itself, that sentence doesn't necessarily mean that Jacob is about to switch them. But when it turns out that he does, that's probably an indication that Jacob already knows what he's planning on doing here in blessing these two sons, that he names the younger before the older here. As we said a second ago, he ultimately gives the birthright to Joseph. There's the Chronicles passage I made reference to as well. Then also part of this is kind of a genealogical inheritance, logistical sort of thing that doesn't mean a whole lot to us, but would have meant a whole lot to the people of that day, and the conquest generation as well. The children, verse 6, the children that you fathered after them shall be yours. They shall be called by the name of their brothers in their inheritance. So he adopts Ephraim and Manasseh as his own children, and they inherit along with the rest of the sons of Jacob. But any other children that Joseph had are counted as Joseph's children, and the way they are going to inherit is with Ephraim and Manasseh, in terms of the physical inheritance, at least the land inheritance. So other sons of Joseph, who we don't know anything about, at least in Genesis, we don't know anything about them. They're inheriting along in the possession of Ephraim and Manasseh is the way all that's going to work out. So again, it doesn't mean a whole lot to us, but that's what's going on in that verse in terms of what the purpose of that verse is. Now, notice also part of the motivation for all of this is because of the death of Rachel. As for me, when I came from Paddan, to my sorrow, Rachel died in the land of Canaan along the way when there was still some distance to go to Ephrath, and I buried her there. And we've talked about Rachel and Leah and kind of the love story of Jacob as it relates to Rachel and Leah and how Rachel, in spite of the good press that she gets in Bible classes, she's really not that great of a person. She seems kind of mean and vindictive and self-centered and shallow. The only good thing the Bible ever says about her is that she was pretty. And Leah is this person that has a prayer life and uses the name of God and names her children things that are hopeful and optimistic and God-centered. And Jacob ultimately decides to bury Leah in the tomb with him and bury Rachel where she died. And all of that, I think, says something. But it doesn't mean that he just absolutely hated Rachel either. He was sorrowful when she died. You see in how he treated Joseph and Benjamin both, that there was something very special about them to him, in part because of who their mother was, and probably in part because of the fact that she had died. In giving Joseph the birthright, it not only gives the birthright to the oldest son of his favorite wife, it gives the birthright to the oldest son of who is supposed to be his only wife based on what his plans were. Remember, he didn't intend to marry Leah first or to have multiple wives and concubines. He just wanted Rachel. And how that would have all worked out for him is an interesting thing to think about. But ultimately, God had other plans and things worked out differently. But Rachel, in his mind, was his wife, who was going to be his wife. And that doesn't happen that way. And then she dies young. And so adopting Ephraim and Manasseh as his own is a way of giving Rachel the children she never got to have, so to speak. And so it increases the number of Rachel's children in the land, and it's a way of paying tribute to her death and to her by giving her three tribes instead of two. It's going to be Benjamin, Ephraim, and Manasseh, rather than Benjamin and Joseph. And so, again, don't get me wrong when I say ultimately he came to have a greater appreciation for Leah than he did for Rachel. I don't think that means that, you know, every time he happened to be traveling through Canaan near the grave of Rachel, he, you know, spat in its direction or anything like that. That's clearly not the case either. And you see that here in this part of the text. All right, anything about the first seven verses? All right, continuing on then in verse 8. Let's see how far I want to go. I'll start in verse 8 and stop when I decide to stop, I guess. When Israel saw Joseph's sons, he said, "Who are these?" Joseph said to his father, "These are my sons, whom God has given me here." And he said, "Bring them to me, please, that I may bless them." Now the eyes of Israel were dim with age that he could not see. So Joseph brought them near him, and he kissed them and embraced them. And Israel said to Joseph, "I never expected to see your face. And behold, God has let me see your offspring also." Then Joseph removed them from his knees, and he bowed down with his face to the earth. And Joseph took them both, Ephraim in his right hand toward Israel's left hand, and Manasseh in his left hand toward Israel's right hand, and he brought them near him. And Israel stretched out his right hand and laid it on the head of Ephraim, who was the younger, and his left hand on the head of Manasseh, crossing his hands, for Manasseh was the firstborn. And he blessed Joseph and said, "The God before whom my fathers Abraham and Isaac walked, the God who has been my shepherd all my life long to this day, the angel who has redeemed me from all evil, bless the boys. And in them let my name be carried on, in the name of my fathers Abraham and Isaac, and let them grow into a multitude in the midst of the earth." When Joseph saw that his father laid his right hand on the head of Ephraim, it displeased him. And he took his father's hand to move it from Ephraim's head to Manasseh's head. And Joseph said to his father, "Not this way, my father. Since this one is the firstborn, put your right hand on his head." But his father refused and said, "I know, my son, I know. He shall also become a people, and he shall also be great. Nevertheless, his younger brother shall be greater than he, and his offspring shall become a multitude of nations." So he blessed him that day, saying, "By you Israel will pronounce blessings, saying, God make you as Ephraim and as Manasseh." Thus he put Ephraim before Manasseh. And I'll stop there. That'll be a good spot to stop because the rest of it's about the burial. So this blessing of Joseph's sons, who are these? Jacob says, and you think, well, he just got done saying Ephraim and Manasseh shall be mine. So I'm pretty sure he knows who they are. So why might he be asking who they are when he has just said their names? Any thoughts on that? Charlie?
What did he do to his father?
Okay. So there is perhaps a recollection of the fact that he has deceived Isaac in this very sort of moment. And so making sure I know who's who, except there is something to be said for Jacob subverting what Joseph is trying to do here with a kind of spiritual insight that goes beyond his physical sight. But certainly there may be something of a recollection of the deception of his father tied in with his poor vision as well. Anything else? He's blind, yeah. So I know my grandsons are coming. I know who they are. But I also know you probably travel with a bit of an entourage because you're such an important person. So I see two fuzzy figures over here near you. Are those the ones I'm looking for, or is it these guys over here? So, I mean, there's kind of a pragmatic sort of possibility there as well. Yeah. Okay, and so the question of who are they? Well, I'm going to tell you who ultimately they really are and what they're going to do, creating the distinction from who they might be now to who they're going to become. There are a couple of other possibilities as well, and again, it's one of those things we can't know for certain. But it's the sort of thing, and again, I would probably lean more toward something either, you know, related to his deception of his father or this kind of contrast between who they are and who they're going to become. But have you ever seen somebody see their, let's say, great nephew, you know, not their nephew, their great nephew, an extra generation, they've seen him for the first time in forever? They say, "Is that really little Johnny? Who is that big kid?" And they know exactly who they are, and it's a way of talking about seeing someone for the first time when you haven't seen them in a while. And so it may be something as simple as that. Some have suggested that it's part of the adoption ritual. He's adopting this child as his own. Have you ever been to a wedding? Who gives this woman? Her mother and I. Well, yeah, we all know that. That's pretty obvious. But it's part of what is done. It's part of the formula of how the whole thing works itself out in our culture. And so there may be something to be said for that, although we don't have enough sort of information about that to say with any sort of certainty that that's what's going on. More interesting than that, that's just kind of a, you know, wrestle with the question that has an obvious answer. Is the conversation that follows in terms of where they are in their lives that they never expected to be, and what the focus of this discussion is. So Jacob says, "I never expected to see your face again." He thinks his son is dead, of course. And this is set in the very context of the fact that he's blind. His eyes are dim with age. "I never expected to see your face again, yet I still see your face again. And not only do I see your face, God has let me see your offspring also." And what a blessing it is to Jacob in the context of his very difficult life. We talked about this some last time when he meets with Pharaoh. You remember, "My days have been few and evil." He's had a pretty rough go of it compared to the other patriarchs. And as we said, some of it's his own doing, but that doesn't mean it was any easier. And for him, near the end of his life, after everything has gone so poorly in so many ways, to not only be able to see Joseph again, but to see Joseph's sons is just an incredible blessing to him. But they weren't just a blessing to him. There's something about these two boys that is an ongoing blessing. You remember, for Joseph, it was a gift after the years of affliction. He was hated by his brothers. He was sold into slavery. He was betrayed by the wife of his master, who had treated him well and lied about, and his master throws him in prison, which, as we said, I think probably indicates that his master didn't believe his wife. It's like, because he doesn't execute Joseph for this capital offense. But still, he's thrown in prison and forgotten about by the people that he helped out there. And finally, he has these children, and what a gift they are to him. And God has blessed me, and I've forgotten my father's house, and I can move forward in my new life. And that's what it was to Joseph. And now to Jacob, it is a different kind of vision, not the sort of vision Jacob had received so much of, but the vision to see these sons after he'd lost a hope of ever seeing Joseph again. But notice also how thoroughly their focus is on God in the midst of all of this. Back up in verse 9, Joseph said to his father, "These are my sons, whom God has given me here." And then in verse 11, Jacob says, "I never expected to see your face, and behold, God has let me see your offspring also." And so this focus on God being behind the blessing of these sons, the blessing they were to Joseph and the blessing they are to Jacob, ultimately it's all a blessing from God, and they are clear in that assessment of the situation. And as we said, Jacob's days, as he calls them, were few and evil back in chapter 47. He's the only patriarch in the book of Genesis to have dealings with his grandsons, at least that we read about, which is a remarkable thing. Isaac may well have had dealings with his grandsons, because Isaac isn't dead when Jacob comes back yet. It's going to be a little while still. We just don't read about it. But in the text, Jacob is the only of these patriarchs to have any dealings with his grandsons whatsoever. Well, Joseph then in verse 12 removes his sons from Jacob's knees, which is an interesting detail all of a sudden to show up. Well, apparently part of the adoption custom was to place the children on or between the knees of the person doing the adopting. It's a symbolic way of saying the child is coming from my body, to kind of replicate the birth process without being too accurate. But you get the idea of what's going on there. Now, in this case, we don't know exactly how this would have worked out. Jacob is very ill and frail, and Jacob is bedridden, and the boys are at least 20 years old probably by this point. So it's probably more of a symbolic sort of thing than an actual, they're sitting on old Jacob's lap. It would be, they're near Jacob, they're near this point. Although, for all I know, they may have done it the way that the ritual was supposed to happen, as much as they could. But whatever the case is, Joseph arranges the sons after this adoption ritual to receive the blessing, and he arranges them so that the older would receive the higher blessing, the blessing of the right hand, and the younger would receive the lesser blessing, the blessing of the left hand. Jacob crosses his hands and blesses the younger above the older. And this is fascinating for a variety of reasons. It's fascinating because Jacob is learning here just how easily God could have directed things all those years ago when he's maneuvering and conniving and working to get this blessing that God had already promised for him. As we said back then, God will use the deceit of Jacob to bless Jacob because God's purpose is for Jacob to be blessed. But God doesn't need Jacob to lie to get that blessing. And I would hazard, based on what I know about what God, what the Bible says about God everywhere else, God doesn't want him to lie either. And here it's as simple as God letting Jacob know what to do and crossing his hands to bless the correct one. And it seems that this is because, ultimately, this is what God wants to be done. Jacob has a vision of the future that the usually clairvoyant Joseph can't see, which is another interesting thing about this. You want to talk about someone who can see the future in this room is Joseph. Joseph sees the future when he has dreams back in chapter 37. Joseph sees the future when his prison mates have dreams. Joseph sees the future, so to speak, when he lays out the perfect plan for what's going to happen. Joseph sees the future, so to speak, when he invites his family down to provide for them. So whether he's literally seeing the future in a vision or interpreting a dream or just, you know, practically speaking, knows what the right thing to do for the future is, Joseph knows the future. And Jacob is the one who's not had that kind of insight. He's the one that's been spending most of his latter years wallowing in pity and saying, "I'm going to die any moment now because I'm going to lose this son or I lost that son or you're going to bring my gray hairs down to Sheol," he says more times than you know, can keep track of off the top of your head. And here, the blind one has insight provided by God, and the usually clairvoyant one doesn't have that sort of insight. But again, the focus of all of this is still God. The God before whom my fathers walked. The God who has been my shepherd all my life long to this day. The angel who redeemed me from all evil, bless the boys. And so it is a blessing from God. And a few things about that, including that kind of odd reference we'll get to in a second. First of all, the God before whom my fathers walked. And this isn't just that they walked alongside God. It's not just that they followed some rules of God, but it speaks to the relationship that they had with God, which is to say that this is all about the covenant that God has made with Abraham and Isaac. It's not just that they happen to be good people. It's that God has reached out to them and they have been in a relationship with God unlike the relationship that other people had with God. And they are walking before God in this relationship. And I think this has with it then an implication that future generations, if they are going to be pleasing to God as well, are going to need to be in this same sort of relationship with God. They must walk before God as well. They must be in a covenant relationship with God as well. And if they're going to be blessed, they must be in this blessed relationship. And so that's where it begins, is the relationship itself. And then there are a couple of analogies that show up to talk about God, the God who's been my shepherd all my life long to this day. For what it's worth, this is the first time that this analogy of God shows up in the Bible. We're very familiar with God as a shepherd. If nothing else, we've all read Psalm 23 like a million times, right? Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want, and so forth and so on. And if you've not read it, you've sung it. In which case, you've kind of read it. So that's really common. You know Jesus, I am the good shepherd, and other passages as well that draw on that kind of imagery. This is the first place it shows up, and it's interesting that it shows up in the mouth of a shepherd, someone who tends flocks, someone who knows what that means. And, you know, the more someone knows about the point of analogy, the stronger the analogy is going to be. At least in terms of their use of it and really getting what it means that that God is a shepherd for him. And God has been my shepherd all my life. Now, the other one is a little bit less obvious and more obscure. The angel who has redeemed me. Are we still talking about God or are we talking about an angel now? What's going on here? Well, a couple things about it. First of all, this is a poetic construction in the Hebrew. And if you remember anything about when we talked about Psalms way back when, the chief feature of Hebrew poetry is parallelism, which is multiple lines in parallel with one another, using synonyms quite frequently or other sorts of ways of talking about the same thing in different terminology. This is in parallel language to the God before whom my fathers walked, the God who has been my shepherd, the angel who has redeemed me. So just in the poetic parallel structure, he's still talking about the same person. And so that, I think, is pretty clear. Also, this is ascribing to this person that he's talking about a divine work, which is redemption. You know, take angel out of here and say, the one who has redeemed me, who are we talking about when we talk about one redeeming somebody? I mean, unless you're talking about literal sort of emancipation of somebody and that sort of redemption, purchase, literal purchase of someone's freedom, in a biblical theological sense, the one who redeems is always God. And so clearly you're talking about one who does a divine work here. But what this is doing ultimately is focusing on the function of an angel. What you've probably heard at some point in your life is the basic word that gets translated angel just means messenger. And what God does for Jacob is he is a God that you are in relationship with, a God that you walk with. But he's also a God who redeems, who delivers you out of bondage, who delivers you out of evil. But he is also a God who talks to you, who speaks to you, who tells you things, which is to say he's a God who has messages. And Jacob, in particular, has had these visible encounters with God at key turning points of his life where God has brought him some sort of message. Whether it's the message in the vision on his way out of the promised land or his wrestling with God on the way back in or any other number of times, God has been a messenger to Jacob. And I think that's really the point of this, are these interactions that Jacob has had with God where God has brought messages to him. So that's the one bit of this description of God that is a little bit odd to us. But ultimately, the point of this isn't to figure out those three elements of how he describes God, but the blessing itself. May he bless the boys, let them grow into a multitude. So it's not about what they're going to do on their own. It's still, as we said earlier, all about God. But again, for God to bless them is not just for God to do good things for them or for God to make them grow, but it's for God to bring them into a relationship with him. All right, let me stop there for a second before we get to Joseph's reactions. Thoughts or questions or comments or anything about this whole scene? Yeah, Charlie.
So, verse 15, the narrator says, Joseph.
Yeah.
So the last several blessings that we've seen have really been, and he blessed Isaac, and Isaac, it was all about Isaac, and then Isaac blessed Jacob, but all about Jacob. And here we have, he blessed Joseph. Bless the boys. Is there a reason why
I think it's just simply the way he blesses Joseph is by blessing Joseph's sons. He's blessing the tribe Joseph by giving him two parts of an inheritance. And it's just kind of a simple way of talking about Ephraim and Manasseh together. Now, why does the narrator choose to say it that way? Maybe as just a reminder that this is not about Ephraim and Manasseh, it's about Joseph. But beyond that, I don't have any strong feeling on it. Noah?
The point of it saying, of this being the first time Shepherd shows up.
Yeah.
I'm wondering, first, is there a comparison with the Egyptians despising the shepherds and then and calling them shepherds? And second, thinking about God who has been my shepherd in the context of Jacob's life, who has been the opposite of what we think of a sheep as, besides Joseph, like someone who's very contrary and has completely rebelled against God in many different ways. And so,
I don't know, because sheep are pretty stupid and contrarian and rebel against the shepherd, and they need a lot of... I think it's a way of saying God has been with him and guided him all through his life. And, the reality is, different people need different amounts of shepherding, and we all need some at least. Jacob has, I think, at times needed a little bit more than some other people in the Bible did. But it's a way of saying that wherever I was, God was there with me. And so I don't know that the point is to reflect so much on his own life and where he's been as much as it is God's continual presence with him. I don't know about the connection to this and the Egyptians feeling about Shepherd. I don't know if he would have made that connection or not. That's an interesting thought. All right, we're quickly running out of time. So Joseph interrupts and says, no, not so, my father, which reminds us of Esau trying to undo the blessing. And Isaac saying, no, my son, what has been said has been said. This is the way it's supposed to be because this is the way that God has wanted it. And Isaac finally humbling himself to that reality. Jacob doesn't have that exact kind of reaction, but the message is still the same. This is what God wants, even if he doesn't say it quite that explicitly. And so this is not going to be reversed. As you think about that other one, blind Isaac was deceived and the blessing wasn't reversed. Blind Jacob wasn't deceived at all. He knew what he was doing. He consciously blessed the younger above the older. And his explanation is, well, the younger is going to be greater than the older. He is, you know, the older is going to be fine too. You don't have to worry about him. But the younger one is going to become the greater one, which is just as we saw back in chapter 27. It's a reaffirmation of the blessing. Esau says, no, you know, don't you have a blessing for me? And Isaac's response is to reaffirm the blessing to Jacob. Likewise, Joseph says, not so, my father, not so. This, you know, you got them all mixed up. And Jacob says, no, this is how it's going to be. And he reaffirms the blessing to Ephraim again. And then what you see is it working out exactly like this. By the time of the judges, Ephraim is the dominant tribe. When the kingdom divides, Ephraim is the known tribe. You kind of forget about all the rest of them. When you read through the prophets, Ephraim is used interchangeably with the northern kingdom. You read in the prophets about Ephraim and Judah constantly. And that's in the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom. Which brings us then to the reality that just as it is in Genesis 37 through 50, so it is in the history of Israel. It's all about Judah and Joseph by the end of things. And the rest of the brothers just kind of fall off the map, more or less, with some exception, of course. But the idea that Ephraim is so dominant that it is used interchangeably with the entire northern kingdom gives you an idea of how much this prophecy actually works itself out. Well, the chapter ends, as my time quickly is as well. Jacob says, behold, I am about to die, but God will be with you and bring you again to the land of your fathers. Moreover, I have given to you, rather than to your brothers, one mountain slope that I took from the hand of the Amorites with my sword and with my bow. So there is, again, I'm about to die, but you are going to go back to this land. You are going to inherit it, just as all the promises have said, just as God has told us all along. But then he mentions specifically that there will be this inheritance, a mountain slope that was taken by force. And you've got two basic options here. One is that this is something the Bible just does not talk about at all, and we just don't know anything about it. And it's the place that it's going to be. And that is a perfectly legitimate option. There's a whole bunch of stuff the Bible doesn't mention, and we just have to live with that. But at the same time, the word that's used here for the mountain slope is a homophone for the word Shechem, which is a land that they took by force. Not to Jacob's liking at the moment, but it is worth noting that this is near the same area where some of these descendants have land, is in the Shechem area. Whether it's taken by sword and bow, I mean, that's really not the way Genesis 34 describes it, but again, it still could be talked about that way. And so either, again, we're talking about something the Bible doesn't talk about anywhere else, or we're talking about Genesis chapter 34. And what that means then is practically speaking, Jacob didn't like what happened. Jacob condemns the actions of his sons. He has not done so verbally yet, but he will in the next chapter in terms of his feeling about Simeon and Levi. But even so, this is, at this point, legitimate spoils of victory, and they are his because they are spoils of victory, and this land is being given to Joseph and his descendants. And so it's a little bit of an odd end to this chapter in terms of something kind of coming out of the blue on us. But that's my best understanding, is it's either talking about Shechem in Genesis 34 or this region and something that we just don't have recorded anywhere else. All right, any last thoughts on chapter 48? All right, well, next time we'll come back and work our way through the blessings to the 12 sons of Jacob that we find in Genesis 49.